I'm Cass Harrington, and you're listening to The Trend. Before we tap into today's conversation on beer, here are your local and regional headlines. A nationally acclaimed documentary featuring Evansville native and Marine Corps veteran Eric Googe airs this weekend before Memorial Day, or Veterans Day. The documentary, Not Yet Begun to Fight, follows Googe and four combat veterans on a fly fishing expedition in Montana. I spoke to Googe about the film and his uneasy transition back into civilian life. Eric Googe was struck by a roadside bomb in Afghanistan. Googe lost his right eye in the explosion. And just 4 days later, he returned home to the United States.
So I didn't really have time to think about what had happened to me and, you know, where I'm going from there.
He says the abrupt change in environment is a painful experience, especially for the veterans who have already endured trauma on the battlefield.
There's a whole series of problems that sort of develops on its own, bringing guys back that quick. There's just no transition. You're just in a really violent situation and then you're home.
But he and four other young combat veterans found peace at a river in Montana where the documentary takes place.
And the documentary isn't about me. It's not about any one specific guy that it shows. It's just it's about what vets are experiencing when they return, especially with regards to some of the more seriously wounded vets.
The film, Not Yet Begun to Fight, chronicles how Eric Googe and these brave men eased their pain by a simple act, fly fishing. The repetitive act of casting out, catching, and releasing another creature, unharmed, back into the water, thousands of miles away from the exploding shells and gunfire of war. Not Yet Begun to Fight airs Sunday, the day before Veterans Day, at 11 p.m. Central on WNIN television. Illinois is set to join 14 other states and the District of Columbia in allowing same-sex marriage. A spokesman for Equality Illinois said the advocacy group's attorneys believe out-of-state couples, like those in Indiana, will be able to get married once the pending law takes effect on June 1st. More than 1.7 million Hoosiers live within 30 minutes of the Illinois state line. A cultural resource management firm based in Mount Carmel, Indiana, has been contracted by Midwest Fertilizer Group to investigate the proposed location of the fertilizer plant in Posey County, west of Mount Vernon. The site is less than a mile away from the Mount Vernon Mound, or so-called GE Mound, near the former General Electric plant. The mound was constructed by the Hopewell Tribe and dates back to the 1st century AD. The firm, Environmental Resource Management Group, is required to submit its findings to the Indiana Department of Natural Resources before the $2.1 billion project can break ground. Here's the state archaeologist Rick Jones from the DNR.
Archaeology rarely stops a project in any situation. It might cost a lot of money if it's a big site or something like that, but you can always excavate a site, and then go ahead and do your project.
A spokesperson for Midwest Fertilizer, Roger Harvey, tells me that the eastern half of the site has been evaluated and cleared for development. I'm investigating this story and will have updates in the days ahead. That's your local and regional news, so grab a mug. It's time to keg today's special beer edition. I'm Cass Harrington, and support for The Trend comes from members of the local programming fund. I'm Cass Harrington, and I'm joined by Vic Schreifer here in the studio. And Vic has some very interesting perspective on brewing here in Evansville. He was the quality assurance manager for Sterling in the 60s is when you started. Is that right, Vic?
1968 when I started.
Right. That's right. And we're also joined by Dan French, who is an engineer here at WNIN. Thanks for coming on the program,
Dan.
You're
welcome.
And we're starting out this conversation by sampling a couple brews here in the studio. We'll give you a debrief here after the conversation. But to start, the first segment of our program, we are going to be talking to the big guys in town. We're talking to Tin Man and the newest brewery, Carson's, which opened last month, actually, to get kind of a perspective of what the larger scale production looks like. And in the second segment, we'll be talking to home brewers which a very lively, passionate group after I went to a couple of their events. And Dan can comment on that. He's a member of the Ohio Valley Homebrewers Association. And then back in the final segment, we'll hear from Vic for some historical perspective on the industry and possibly what we're looking at in the years to come. So let's start by hearing from, John Mills, who is the head brewer at Carson's, like I said, the newest brewery in town. So let's hear what he has to say.
For our segment on beer, I thought we could not go ahead with the story without talking with someone from Carson's, because you're the newest brewery in town. Just opened October 4th was the official opening, and I wanted to know first, how has the reception been so far?
It's been great. Evansville has really welcomed us with open arms. We're the third brewery, microbrewery now in Evansville, and room to grow.
It's a trend that's been sweeping across the country, that people are interested in smaller batch brews and craft brews. But here, I mean, there is an interest for this. It's not necessarily a niche.
No, it's not necessarily a niche. It goes along with, I want to say, drinking responsibly. So instead of drinking to excess of multiple six-packs, you just have a couple of beers and enjoy yourself. And enjoying that quality.
Like I said, it is something that has taken off recently, that more people are interested in home brewing, in enjoying an artisan brew. So I wanted to get behind what your hypothesis might be, why this is, particularly in Evansville.
You have to think of maybe what the consumer is really thinking. It's a good value for their money. Craft beer seems to be your best value. You're getting a nice flavor, a nice variety of things. It's not just the same ho-hum, drum, cold fizzy stuff. That's a common question. People ask me, what's my favorite beer? And it changes according to the season and according to the time. Because sometimes I really like a light, cold, fizzy beer. And other times when it's cold out, I like to enjoy, wrap up with a nice snifter of a heavy, highly alcohol-flavored beer.
And, well, how did you fall into brewing and working with Carson's?
I was a home brewer. I was a home brewer for many years. I started home brewing because I was a poor college student that wanted to drink more expensive beers, and just didn't have the income for it. So I had to learn and do it myself. And part of that also was I wanted to be able to try styles of beer, but just living in Indiana, I just didn't have the availability to be even able to purchase them, regardless of what the price was. So I had to learn to try to make those styles at home. So coupling that together, there was a lot of people enjoying my beer, but the best beer in the world is always free. So that's kind of hard to judge when you're giving your beer away to people, they say it's great. So I entered some contests, and one of them being the Indiana State Fair. And I won Best of Show in the Indiana State Fair.
Wow.
Won several other awards and ribbons, different contests. And Jason Carson, the owner of Carson's Brewery, wound up talking, having a few beers one day, and now it's Carson's Brewery.
So any hopes of, getting some national acclaim for Carson's? It seems like Indiana is fertile ground for craft brews with Three Floyds. And so.
There is many award-winning breweries in Indiana. I haven't seen it written down, but I've heard through the grapevine that there are some national breweries, larger breweries, that are not entering the Indiana beer market because we're already a home state for great beer, that the competition's too tough to make great beer in. But I don't see it. It's like there's room for everybody.
That was me talking with John Mills, who is the head brewer at Carson's, a new brewery here in town. And I forgot to mention, the reason why it's a little noisy is I was at the Wesselman Woods Wandering Owl event, and that was kind of a wine and beer event on the trail at Wesselman. And it was so lively, so interesting to see all the different breweries, and there was the Homebrewers Association had a booth set up. So, well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to take a trip to Tin Man. Here comes the nighttime.
You're listening to The Trend here on 88.3 WNIN. Still to come, Vic Schreifer, a former chemist who used to work for Sterling in the 1960s, talks about the evolution of brewing here in Evansville, past, present, and possible projections for the future. All that plus more drinking in the studio coming up as The Trend continues. Support comes in part from Evansville Day School, partnering with parents to offer a student-centered education program for students junior pre-kindergarten through 12th grade. More information at evansvilledayschool.org or at 812-476-3039.
You're listening to The Trend on WNIN. I'm your host, Cass Harrington, joined by Vic Schreifer and Dan French, two local beer aficionados. And we were just commenting off the air about that first clip that played from the Wesselman Woods event from John Mills, the head brewer at Carson's. He said something about how the massive brewers are kind of intimidated by the market here. What was that?
I think that was the intent of the statement. The macro brews are tending to try to disguise some of their macro brews as craft brews, and there's some of the craft brewers take exception to that. So
I hadn't really heard that. That's something new to me. I mean, I've gone to various stores around, but I've not seen any, you know, empty shelves because they didn't supply. They're still here.
Yes.
Certainly. I think what Dan is saying, correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like, well, Budweiser has, for example, has a marketing campaign that uses the word craft and really kind of they're doing some different things with their branding and some new styles, but maybe that's not quite as popular here. Our market seems to splinter that.
Well, there's definitely a strong niche for the craft, the true craft brews here in Indiana.
But not necessarily from the mass market.
Right. I think that's becoming more and more evident. You know,
There's room for everybody.
Yeah, there is.
There really is.
That's the attitude that I have heard across the board. There's room for everyone.
There is.
I think that's a distinctly beer remark.
it's true. You know, you can't please everybody all the time.
That's right.
And that consequently, which you don't like somebody else will. So.
I want to talk to you all more. There's so much here in this show. But first, let's take a trip to Tin Man Brewery, where I took a little tour. And the brewer there, Keenan, he showed me a machine that's kind of unique to Tin Man, which is the mash filter, which is, I think it's the smallest brewery of its size to have one in the country. So it's very unique. Let's have a listen.
We are walking into the employees only area.
Yeah, this is the doorway into the brewery. It's the one that just about everybody that comes into the brewery or into the tap room, this is what they see. And really what they see is the brew house sitting here. It's a three-vessel brew house with a mash filter. And that's a mash tun, a mash filter, a kettle, and a whirlpool. The biggest difference between ours and most other systems you might find in a craft brewery is our mash filter takes the place of a louder tun.
Yeah, show us or the listeners that machine.
So the mash filter is a series of plates. Every other plate has a balloon inside of it, or basically has a bladder inside of it that we fill with water to expand and extract and squeeze all of the grain to get all of the wort out, all the sweet wort available. At the end of it, all of the grain just slides out. It really just looks like a sheet of pressed grain, and it's dry. And it doesn't taste too good. We've all tasted it, and every now and then we'll take a bite.
So you used a really interesting analogy to describe what this machine does.
So on a traditional brew house, you'll operate what's called either a mash louder tun or a separated mash and louder tun. And what a louder tun does is you have a false bottom that all of your milled, crushed grain sits on top, and you run hot water through there basically to extract all of the sweet liquor from the grain. And that's very similar to the same way that like a drip coffee filter works. You'll have a bed of coffee sitting in your coffee filter. And in the same way, this acts very much like the false bottom on a louder tongue. On a mash filter, it's much similar to a French press. You have very finely ground grain that's going into one big pot. So you get a very fast, very high efficiency brew. Very much the same way you get a very high efficiency, high quality brew from a French press.
And it's delicious.
And it is delicious.
So, okay, we're looking at a lot of shiny equipment.
Yeah.
A very unique piece of machinery. But still, the process is, it's the same.
It's, at the end of the day, we're still just converting starch into sugar, extracting it out into water, and then boiling hops into it, and then cooling it down and putting yeast in. And it's the same thing that any all-grain home brewer does. It's really the same thing that just about any brewer has done for the last 3,000, 5,000, you know, since the dawn of time. That's the exact same thing. It's starch conversion into water.
Okay, let's keep
going. Yeah,
talking.
Let's keep going.
So everything back here is the brew house. So if you walk into Tin Man and you get into the tasting room and you look through our windows, majority of what you see is the brew house. What you don't really get to see very much of is what we refer to as the cellar, which is where all of our tanks, all of our fermenters are set up. All of the beer is either in process, meaning it's really at some stage in the process from being unfermented wort to being fully carbonated, ready to drink beer.
Did you hear that, listeners? Not many people see this, so you get to hear it.
Well, you can always come in on a Saturday afternoon and come do a tour. I can't really think of any other industry, maybe except for organic farming, where people come through and they see where their food, because beer is food, where their food is coming from. And so all the more reason for people to go out there and say, you know what, I went to Upland and they've got a really clean brewery, or I've gone to Carson's and you know what, they've got a really clean brewery, or whatever. And that, if nothing else, that instills a sense of confidence in, you know, a consumer going out buying a beer. They know, you know what, I know that they are not only making good beer, but they're making good beer well. What's over here? So this is our Russian Imperial Stout that we brewed yesterday. And what you're seeing here is a hose coming off of the very top of the tank where all of the CO2, which is a byproduct of fermentation, all of that excess CO2 is bubbling up through a hose into a bucket filled with water. That positive pressure coming off of the hose into that water sort of creates a poor man's airlock where nothing can get back into the tank. So if we've got a very sanitary environment inside the tank, it stays that way because nothing can get inside. It sounds really good to us, mostly because if you were to brew a beer, you walk in and you don't hear that sound, then there's something bad. There's something didn't go right.
It's very sterile. It's like a laboratory.
We do our best. We work tirelessly to try and keep this place clean and to keep it as immaculate as it is. And even then, we still get a little caught up on little things where we'll find a little speck of dirt or a little bit of grime and we'll just say, okay, well, I know what I'm going to do before I leave today. I'm going to spend 20 minutes scrubbing that.
Well, and how easy is it to screw up?
It's screwing up on this level or this size of brewing is simultaneously very hard and very easy because there are small variations that will still create a very good product, will still create something that people will enjoy. It's still going to be a very good beer, but it's going to change consistency throughout your product.
Well, and I imagine too that, you know, there has to be a certain kind of culture or trust between everyone here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, everybody here, we we are very honest with each other as far as what we feel comfortable with or what we feel comfortable with, what we know, what we acknowledge that we might not know. It's very collaborative. My background is in the art world. I studied theater at the University of Texas, and that's my approach to this process, which is it's an artistic product. You're pulling lots of different ingredients from a palette, no pun intended. You're pulling lots of different ingredients, trying to make one good product, and you have a production where it starts from one end and it ends in another end, and you have all these things that have to happen in between, and you have to rely on your team. And we have a really, really good team here at Tin Man.
It's like a dance.
It is. We actually use that term quite often. So we use the term tank dancing often when things start getting a little too tight as far as transferring it from one tank to another. Here, I'll even show you. I'm not going to start dancing. I'm just going to show some sort of written out choreography. So this is our production board, and it's just a big dry erase board that has everything that's going on for about 4 to 5 weeks out. And written all over it is batch numbers, types, what process is going to happen, everything for the next couple of weeks. And included on that is a diagram of every single one of our tanks, what's in it, what the status is, if it's empty, is it clean, is it dirty, is it full of CO2, what's going on with that tank. And so we'll sit here sometimes for admittedly way too long thinking about, well, 5 weeks from now, what's going to be in this tank that is currently full of our Pilsner? Where are we going to be? And so tank dancing is where you go, so this guy is going to be filled with this, and then it's going to be emptied 1 week later, and then this is going to go into that. And it is just the constant changing of partners. If you think of beer as one partner and you think of the tank as the other, it's just they're constantly do-si-do-ing, if you will, all throughout the production cycle.
That's a great. I love that. Well, especially because one person I talked to at the homebrew meeting, his emphasis was this is a science, and just, you know, talk about the engineering aspect and all of this, but you say it's art.
I oftentimes refer to craft brewing specifically as very much a renaissance industry where you have, depending on who you're talking to, you've got equal parts science and art and just ingenuity coming together to create a good product, to create a wonderful beer. So you'll have something small, like we'll do a little test batch with something that, you know, we'll do something crazy where we'll throw, pink peppercorn in an IPA, for instance. That was a batch we did a while back. And doing that on a small scale, on a homebrew scale, is fairly easy. And you've got a lot of artistry and ingenuity in that. But then when you start scaling that up and you want to do that on a large industrial scale, that's where it requires the engineering and the science, and you have to have a great intimate understanding of what it is you're doing.
There you go, the art and science of brewing at Tin Man. We have a resident brewer here today, Vic Schreifer, excuse me.
Schreifer, close enough.
Schreifer, who worked for Sterling in 1968 for 25 years.
Through 94.
And so when you were listening to that, did it... you were nodding your head at some points, and then you sounded puzzled at others. What's going on?
Yeah, he's right. 95% of it I totally agreed with. There was something he said they experimented with, or they added to the...
Peppercorns.
Peppercorn, yeah. I've never heard that before, so I don't know what peppercorn does. Is it a spice?
Yeah, it's a spice, yeah. Like in a pepper mill.
Okay. The only spice I ever dealt with in a beer... we used to put jalapeno peppers, in a bottle, and to fill it up.
And it was spicy.
Did you ever eat a jalapeno pepper?
Yeah.
Then you can imagine it does the same thing to a bottle of beer. It makes it just as warm as it can be, and then we'd send that to Mexico. They loved it.
Oh, I used to buy it here.
Did you?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know they had it here.
You didn't want to drink more than one at the time.
No, that was enough.
I can just think about the heartburn.
It got your attention.
I'm sure.
If you got an ulcer, you don't want to drink that.
Well, Vic, you have a chemistry background, which drew you to that job at Sterling. You saw an ad in the paper.
Well, yeah. I graduated from U of E with a major in biology and chemistry. Had double major. And they had an ad in the paper for a microbiologist. So I thought, well, you know, that's just right down my alley. So yeah. My degree was in teaching. Mm-hmm. And I had 3 months of student teaching, and I knew that wasn't for me. So I answered the ad and got the job, and one thing just led to another one. So I was a microbiologist for about 4 years, maybe five. And then they had an assistant brewmaster who had some health problems. Uh-huh. And I took over his spot for a couple of years. And then I eventually wound up into the lab part of it.
Quality assurance.
Yeah.
It's so interesting. You know, and the dozens of brewers and home brewers I spoke to, it's kind of that classic story. Well, I wound up here after, but they're all happy doing it.
It's a good job, and the brewery was a wonderful place to work. And you had good people working there, and he talked about keeping it clean. Well, that's 95% of the battle. You got to keep it clean.
Oh, yeah. He said that this is, you know, people stop me and say, I want your job. And he says, you have no idea. Yeah. I am moving stuff, cleaning.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
We used to run solution, what they call solution, every Friday evening through the whole plant. All the fermenting, all the storage, all the blend tanks, the government stuff, everything. For one whole shift, that's all they did was sterilize all the pipelines for the following coming up week.
Oh.
But it had to keep it clean.
Well, I saw you holding up yours and Dan's beer. Could you tell me what you noticed? You're sipping an amber lager.
Let me, I can show you.
He was holding it up to the window.
Can you tell the difference in those two beers?
I see one is slightly darker than the other.
Okay. All right.
What's going on?
That's right. What that tells you is that these did not come from the same place.
Really?
No, yeah. It had to be the same color. So this is made from a different batch or something. Uh-huh. And it's just little things you pick up like that.
Not that
it makes any difference in the taste. It doesn't.
No consistency problem.
But
just
they may have added a little more color to this than they did to this.
Huh. Very interesting. Yeah. Well, I look forward to hearing more of your expertise later on in the program. For now, we are going to segue into the culture of the Home Brewers Association. And trust me, it is its own culture. It's its own community. I first went to the Ohio Valley Home Brewers Association meeting, which was, you know, about 150 people at Germania
Manicor.
Thank you, Dan. And along, you know, sitting along rows of long tables, and everybody had their own growler or jug of what they had been making in thermoses. It reminded me of, you know, Time Warner cartoons with the XXs on the jugs. It was fun. And everybody was sharing and sampling, and it was a good time. So I've got a clip from the president, Don Heisler. And let's take a listen to that, hear his take on the craft brewing movement.
I call it my golf. It's a hobby that I can do. I can do at home. It doesn't involve a lot of expense. It's something I can personally enjoy, and I can give my beer out. We donate a lot of our beer at different events, the Brew at the Zoo and some of the other events around town. And I enjoy sharing it with them. Camaraderie tonight, you know, we all like to share our beer. We like to other people to taste our beer. None of us drink all the beer we make. That would be hard, but we enjoy giving it away and sharing it with other people.
And that's the spirit of the Home Brewers Association. Just a lot of camaraderie. It was almost like a fraternity. And what was going on that night is two men were presenting a contraption they made. Maybe, Dan, you can talk about this a little better. But it looked really elaborate. Part of it was
plumbing, very sophisticated plumbing, and the other half had a switchboard. So these two guys, one had a background in plumbing, and the other was an electrician or did cables. What was that, Dan?
Well, in the homebrew world, they're referred to as sculpture.
Sculpture.
So, yes, and you'll see different sculptures from very simple to elaborate, which is what you saw. Very elaborate.
It was. Yeah. I can't imagine, because some people do homebrewing because in the end, it's relatively cheaper. If you want craft beer, make it yourself. But it seemed that contraption was quite expensive and and detailed.
It can be cheaper, but I think all the crafters will tell, or the homebrewers will tell you it's not cheaper.
Yeah.
But it's fun, and they enjoy it.
Yeah.
And you can make it the way you want it.
Exactly.
Yeah, that was the biggest thing, was the personalization of it.
Yeah, that's half the fun. You can make it as complicated as you want to.
Exactly.
Or as simple as you want to.
And there's an escalation. You know, you start simple, and then you work your way up to the bigger beers and the Belgians and whatever that you like, that's what you're going to
make. You can make it that way.
Yeah.
And it's whatever you want. It's a good hobby to have. Huh. I should get down with the brewer someday.
You should.
Yeah, I should come there.
It's a very lively group. I can tell you that. I felt very welcome. So much so, I followed up and I went to one of their weekend events, which was a Learn to Homebrew, and they had a setup outside of Liquor Locker. And I talked to Christopher Norick, who is the secretary of the Ohio Valley Homebrewer Association. So let's listen in on my interview with Christopher.
Christopher Norick. I am the secretary of the Ohio Valley Homebrewers Association, and I'm also a senior graphic designer out at University of Southern Indiana.
For the sake of what's going on today, could you give the listeners kind of a rundown of what a Learn to Homebrew event looks like?
Well, it's a national event that we participate in. We actually do two public brew days a year, so this is the fall event. We also do one in the spring. And it's exactly what it says. We bring guys out from the club. They bring whatever brewing equipment they have. So we've got guys that have a very fancy, almost scale model of a big brew house, such as, you know, out at Trone's or out at Tin Man or Carson's, just scaled down to about 10-gallon size. We've got guys that have single burner, one brew pot systems, very simple. And they're brewing an extract kit, which most of the mail order houses have brewing kits, as well as the both homebrew stores in town. And it has malt extract in it, so a lot of the work's already done. You're basically brewing malted barley extract and adding your hops. So that's sort of the really simple couple-hour process. And then we have kind of the in-between, which is a new technique that started probably 5 years ago, and it's brew in the bag. So you're doing the all-grain version where you're taking malted barley, you're crushing it just like the big guys do, an actual microbrewery, and it's all in one vessel. So you put a big filter bag in there, and you put your grain, and you do your mashing for an hour. You pull it out like a big strainer, and then you do your boil, add your hops. When you mash, you're activating enzymes that are in the grain that convert starches to sugar. And so you're heating it up to about 154 degrees. You let it sit for an hour. You stir it a few times. And those enzymes are doing all the conversion. So you pull all that grain out because you just want the liquid. And then you're left with sugary water because the yeast eat the sugar and make alcohol and CO2. So, I mean, that's the light technical overview of brewing.
Well, it's really interesting. When I went to the meeting, a lot of people I talked to are in science and engineering fields. Is this a scientific procedure?
It can go that way, and some guys are really into that. I mean, I do have a biology degree, and so you kind of learn about fermentation science a little bit in biology and things like that. So there is an aspect of science to it because you start dealing with water chemistry, pH levels, the enzyme reactions, all of the salt additions, like what's in the water, you know, calcium ions, things that you can manipulate to actually affect the final outcome of the beer. Or it can be very simple. You buy the kit. Most of it's already done for you. You do it in your kitchen on a stovetop, and you're actually making some reasonably good beer. So it can definitely, you can make the hobby whatever you want.
So how long have you been a member of the Homebrew Association here, and how has the demographic or the size of the group changed?
When I got in, it was probably 8 years ago, maybe 9 years ago. And I had done a little bit of brewing when I was in college. And I kind of got out of it. I made a couple of kit beers, and they weren't that good. And back then, there was a homebrew store called Beer and Wine by You. And so I got a kit there, and I made a couple batches, and they were okay, and I didn't really do much with it.
And was this for economic reasons? Was it so beer was cheaper as a college student?
I mean, that may have been a part of it, but I like acquiring skills. I have lots and lots of hobbies, and that was just one more thing. I was like, oh, you can make your own beer. Well, that sounds interesting. You know, there's a little history aspect to it. People used to brew their own beer all the time. I'll see if I can do that. And so that didn't really go anywhere. And a few years after, I ended up over at the Evansville Museum at an event called the Brewhaha. And the club was there pouring all these wonderful beers for the public. And, I mean, it kind of clicked. I'm like, oh, there's a club. Because there is a learned aspect to that skill. I mean, brewing, you have to learn it. It's you have to develop the skill. And having a group of guys that already had done it, had kind of refined some things, had tips and tricks, I joined up immediately. There was maybe 20 members at that time. I mean, it was a pretty small little group. We met once a month, skipped a few months in the summer. We didn't have meetings. And it's grown every year since then. I mean, now we're well over 140 members, I believe, was the last count. So, and most of that growth has occurred in the last probably 4 years. I mean, it's almost like we've doubled each year over 4 years.
This doesn't necessarily have to do with brewing, but it was just something I noticed Wednesday, and I wondered if anyone had talked about. It was like almost 200 people, mostly, well, all white. And I've looked into brewing groups across the country, and there really isn't much diversity. Does anyone ever talk about that?
I've not heard much mentioned about that. I mean, we've gotten a lot more women involved this year. We did kind of adjust our membership structure where you could add a spouse or significant other. We called our couples membership. And so that's brought in a lot more. And, I mean, there's somebody brewing outside right now, a woman. She's brewing because her boyfriend had to go get his hair cut today during brew day. So she's out there brewing right now. She's going to enter our contest on her own with her own recipes. So, I mean, we have that diversity, but racially, I have no idea. I mean, we go up to Indianapolis. There's a statewide homebrew contest for the state fair. And I see the same thing. It's predominantly, you know, white guys. I mean, that's really where it is. And I don't know why that is.
Heaven, there is no beer. That's why we drink it here. And when we're gone from here, all our friends will be drinking all our beer.
You're listening to The Trend on 88.3 WNIN FM. Support today comes from Raben Tire and Auto Service, a proud sponsor of WNIN programming. Raben's trained technicians provide complete auto service, including brakes, alignment, oil and lube, and all recommended maintenance, along with tire brands like Michelin and Goodyear. Information on the web at RabenTire.com.
La 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 la.
A hypothesis why this is, or why there is this surge in craft brews? It just seems to keep growing exponentially year by year.
It's tough to explain it exactly. You know, there's probably a lot of things going on. there's a whole brewing history that goes back. You know, Prohibition really knocked down the number of breweries to a minuscule level. And then there was this whole theory about World War II affecting even all consumer goods, not just beer. People went to the bland, manufactured, easy, you know, no real adventure in flavors. And so that whole swing has sort of been taking place in food. You know, people are liking local, homegrown, that whole movement. And that ties into the brewing movement.
And do you see it slowing down at any point?
I've seen a few charts where it showed how many breweries existed before Prohibition and where we are now. And the growth curve is still going up. I mean, it's still sort of in this exponential growth phase. There was a little bump in the 80s when a bunch of brew pubs opened up, and it was sort of a mad dash to make money because you could almost sell anything, and the quality kind of suffered in the 80s, and there was kind of a dip where the public was like, well, yeah, it's local, but it doesn't taste very good. And so a few of those closed. We had a few in town, I think that happened to, or at least one in town, down on Main Street. And so now we're past that lull, and the quality is just unbelievable. I mean, I hear all these interviews where they say, you know, America is where all the good stuff's happening. I mean, you have the historical European beer that everybody thinks is the best, but all the innovation is happening in America because we're making all the stuff that they can make as good, and we're still experimenting with other things.
So maybe the trend is that people are experiencing something that's personalized in the way they want it, and once they find something they like, maybe they don't want to go back to something like a Bud Light.
Oh, exactly. I mean, once you kind of get that taste for the flavor, you know, it actually has its unique character. I mean, it's tough to go back to some of those other beers that are just very plain and watery, and there's no real inspiration there. It's just, okay, it's beer, in quotation marks. Yeah.
Well, is there any projections or kind of niches that you think have yet to be discovered in terms of brewing here locally?
There's a lot of room for growth. Taroni's has been around for 17 years. They've had some base styles, and they usually have one or two, maybe four or five seasonal beers. We've had Tin Man open up recently, and they kind of have their core beers, and they were doing a few specialties on their small system for special releases on Friday. Carson's has just opened up. So now all of a sudden we have all of these avenues for experimentation. So yeah. I don't know what. You can't really predict what the next thing is because it's been all over the place. Hoppy beers were huge 4 or 5 years ago. You know, make it as hoppy and as bitter and as dank and in your face as you could do it.
Hop Slam.
Exactly, and those are still around, and they continue to kind of be on the top of the best beers charts. But there's so much other things going on. Session beers have been popular in the last year or so. That's sort of a lower alcohol but flavorful beer that you can sit at a pub, have one or two or three. You know, you're not getting drunk. You're just sitting there enjoying a nice flavored beer.
There you go. Enjoy a nice flavored beer. That's something that's really weathered the test of time, right?
Nothing wrong with that.
Right. So, no, I saw you shaking your head, Vic. Quality suffered in the 80s, huh?
I didn't think so.
Yeah, you were working
I mean,
at the
my
time.
Job was still there, and I was still doing it. We still made a pretty good bottle of beer, I thought. I didn't know it was been suffering so much. He talked about the brewery on Main Street that closed. Was that the Evansville brewery? I'm not sure which one that was.
I could look at my trusty map here.
Because I'm a historian, I'm not much on that, but I know when I went into the business back in 68, there were two breweries, Cook's and Sterling.
Mm-hmm.
And... well, now I'll take that back. Cook's may have already shut down by that time. But there were two brewers that I know of that were in town, and I don't go back much farther than that.
Yeah, it looks like it's kind of almost an incestuous relationship. There's a family tree here.
Yeah.
Sterling and Evansville Brewing Company.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. But so that was an interesting clip, and I wanted to play really quickly Jill Mecklenburg. I spoke with her that same day at the Learn to Homebrew event, kind of following up from Christopher Norick's comment that there's not much diversity in the craft brewing culture. Garrett Oliver with Brooklyn Brewery is one of the few African-American brewers in the country, and we're talking about, you know, an industry of like 3,000 microbreweries nationwide. So it was definitely a talking point. But here's Jill Mecklenburg and why she's a home brewer.
My name is Jill Mecklenburg, and I am a validation engineer.
Oh my gosh, can you tell me what that is?
So I work for an engineering consulting firm, and I work out at Bristol-Myers Squibb, and I test the equipment and the processes out there.
Well, it's been my experience with a lot of people I've talked to in this club that a lot of people have a science background. Is that something that drew you to homebrewing?
Yes, I was drawn to homebrewing just years ago, but I've never actually did it until I met my boyfriend. So he's a chemist, and he'd been brewing for years, so I said I jumped in on it, basically.
Were you intimidated at all by the vast group of men that are in this club?
As an engineer, not really. I'm pretty used to being around men, and it's comfortable, so not really.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just thought it was really interesting, because I went to the meeting Wednesday night, and there were, you know, probably 200 people there, four or five were women, and...
Yeah, it's typically mostly men, and then some people bring their wives and girlfriends, and... Yeah.
Well, what do you like about homebrewing?
I like having choices of beer to drink at all times. So we keep a few kegged right now. We've got 5 kegs, and just I like having the choices. But it also brings out a little of my nerdy side that I like the chemistry and the engineering behind it. It's fun. You get to do whatever you want too. You can try all different kinds of things. People try like pepper beers, chocolate beers, peanut butter beers. You just things that you don't buy at the store. So that's what I really like about it.
Do you and your boyfriend have the same taste in beer, or do you have two different complete setups?
No, we have one setup that's over here right now, and we both like pretty hoppy beers, so we tend to add a lot of hops. He likes more Pilsners, and I enjoy the Belgians, but yeah, we find a middle ground a lot of times.
And so that was Jill Mecklenburg, a member of the Homebrewers Association here in town. And before we wind down the whole conversation, I wanted to work backwards chronologically, because I think history is the future. That's my take. So the last clip I want to listen to is Jack Fry, who's the head brewer at Taroni's, which was it's been in here in Evansville for 17 years now. And then we'll have Vic's final take on where Evansville is headed.
I'm Jack Fry. I'm the head brewer at Taroni's Main Street Brewery here in Evansville, and I'm also the treasurer of the OVHA, and I'm one of three of the founding members that are still there.
How long has Taroni's been in town brewing beer?
Taroni's opened the brewery in 96. The owner's son was the first brewer, and he brewed until about 99, 2000, and they hired their first trained brewer. His name was Eric Watson, and he was real instrumental in improving the brewery. Then in 2003, he hired me, and in 2004, he left and I took over. So I've been the head brewer longer than anybody else.
Why did he hire you? Had you experienced homebrewing or brewing at all before?
I started homebrewing in 96. I worked at Old National for close to 30 years, and they kicked me out in 2003. And I had 39 weeks of severance and a trip to Europe planned, so I took the summer off. And during the summer, I'd go in and help Eric while he was brewing. Well, I actually didn't really help him. I stood there and talked to him. Took our trip to Europe and got home, and it's like, well, now I have to find a real job. And Eric called and said, I'm looking for an assistant. So I went in and talked to him. He said, I'm only going to be here another year. I look at it as training my replacement. And it's like, I can do that. So I started and been there ever since.
Well, and I have to ask, with two new breweries in town, do you feel overcrowded, or does that add to the interest of craft brews in town?
Not overcrowded at all. We're big enough that we could definitely support a couple more. You know, it's rising tides float all boats. I'm quite happy to see other people here. Really? It gives me the opportunity to drink somebody else's beer sometimes, besides the home brewers. But yeah, I completely welcome the new guys here, and I'm glad to see them. We've got plenty of room for everybody. But there's something unique about the brewing industry where even the big boys, even though us little guys are taking their market share, they still share knowledge and stuff. I'm not sure why that is. It is getting big enough now that it's starting to get a little bit more hardcore. There's breweries suing other breweries for copyright infringements and stuff. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out in the next few years. The biggest one lately was Magic Hat and a brewery in Lexington. Yeah. And there's been a few of those. But all in all, brewers are an interesting group of people. When I started, probably 90% of the brewers had facial hair for some reason.
I'm glad you said that and not me.
And I don't know why.
My last question is, you've got a remarkable shirt. It's covered in beer labels. Is there a story behind that?
No, I found it here in town somewhere. Most of my T-shirts and shirts have some kind of beer-related thing to them for some reason. I just don't quite understand why.
It's something I've picked up on, that more than a hobby or a job, a career, it's also something people take pride in to really extreme degrees sometimes.
Yeah, it's there's definitely an art to it. The first time you go to the public and start serving your beer and they come back and tell you how great it is, your head gets to be huge. Yeah, there's real pride in serving something that people like and come back for. And it's an interesting career. Doesn't pay very well, but it is a lot of fun.
That was Jack Fry, the head brewer at Taroni's. And before we close out today's program on beer, I wanted to hear again from Vic Schrieffer, who was the quality assurance manager at Sterling back in the day. And so tell us, where are we headed? Are things, you know, what's changed and what stayed the same?
I think the brewing industry is similar to the car industry. You're always going to have the Budweisers and the Coors, but there's always room for the little guy. Plenty of room, no problem.
And that's the attitude across the board that I saw. Yeah. It was very welcoming, really strange. So, well, Dan French, thank you also for joining us in the studio. He's a member of the Home Brewers Association. And there you have it. The craft beer explosion is making waves here, locally, across the country. And like Jack Fry from Taroni's and Vic Schrieffer here said, there is room for more growth. I'm your host, Cass Harrington. You've been listening to The Trend. If you ever want to know more about a person or a project or event mentioned on the program, head over to The Trends page at WNIN.org. Or if you liked a song you heard on the program, you can also find our playlist there. Tune in next week for an in-depth look at local family farms and access to healthy foods. The Trend is a production of WNIN in collaboration with the Evansville Courier and Press. This episode was produced by myself with help from Ryan Reynolds at the Courier and Press. My friend Tony Voss engineered today's live show. The theme and music was written by the talented Jeffrey Osman. I'm Cass Harrington. We'll talk next week. This is WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro. Cheers!